From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Congress struggles to pass a new farm bill by January 1st, higher dairy prices could be the price we pay if they don't.
We would see a dramatic increase in those prices, and that is not what farmers want.
Plus, how about playing your lottery numbers on your laptop or smartphone?
You would be able to gamble online on your computer or on your smartphone through a series of, I think, about 2 dozen games at the initial outset.
Are folks up north getting burned out with tourists and festivals?
The gentleman who this past summer went to the city officials and proposed throwing what he called the Quiet Festival, which would be reserving the open space for a time where absolutely nothing would go on.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Can you imagine paying $7 for a gallon of milk? Well, that reality isn't too far off if Congress cannot get it together and pass a new farm bill. We'll find out more about the so-called dairy cliff on today's show. And then scientists say Lake Superior is heating up faster than any other lake on Earth. We'll ask why later this hour. But first, a move by the Michigan Lottery has caught retailers by surprise. Big surprise. Earlier this year, the state legislature said no to a budget request from the Michigan Lottery. They were looking for money to launch online and smartphone lottery sales. Store owners who sell lottery tickets figured that was the end of that. Well, it turns out they were wrong. Chris Gouts has been following this story for Crane's Detroit Business, and he joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
So what happened after the legislature stripped that money from the lottery budget?
Well, if you were to ask the Grocers Association or the Associated Food and Petroleum Dealers, they got pretty much nothing. They had thought that this was a done deal, like you said, and that nothing was going to happen. And then just a few days ago that they found out that that was not the case, that the lottery had been going ahead unbeknownst to them and pushing through with this and received back an RFP and selected someone to start negotiating a contract with to actually do the online lottery.
So it certainly seems as though that ship has sailed.
For now, yeah, it seems to. I mean, I suppose that the legislature could do something in some way if they wanted to. I'm not sure what they could do. But, yeah, it does sound like this is really going forward now.
So how would it work? How would the Michigan Lottery phase in and add these online and smartphone sales?
Well, there's still a lot to be debated and discussed between the lottery and the firm, the Canadian firm that won this Pollard Banknote Limited. They were chosen through the process, but now they'll work on the actual contract language and try to figure out how to do it. But the idea in general is that you would be able to gamble online on your computer or on your smartphone through a series of, I think, about 2 dozen games at the initial outset that the company would create, and it would just be, you know, sort of like you'd play a scratch-off game that you'd buy at the store, but you could play it on your phone.
And I'm suspecting they're looking at maybe getting more people into the habit of playing the lottery.
Yeah, that's really the idea. And the states that have tried this, there's two other states that have done this. And the idea from the lottery perspective is that what you're going to do is you're going to find all these, 20-somethings or millennials that probably don't play the lottery now, but who live on their smartphones, you know, every day it's in their hands and every hour of every day.
They sleep with their smartphones. Come on.
Absolutely. It's their alarm clock. Yeah. So the idea is that if you can get them to start playing it on their phone, that they would become sort of regular lottery customers. And that line of thinking is sort of a way to try to appease the grocers and the retailers to try to say, look, we're not going to be taking away any of your customers. What we're going to be doing is bringing you a new set of customers. That hasn't really sunk in. I don't know that the retail folks are necessarily buying that line of thinking just yet.
So are the retailers offering up any ways to keep themselves in this process?
Yeah, absolutely. At least on one front, although the lottery is not confirming this, that they worked out supposedly a deal that with retailers that they will not offer the daily 3 and daily 4 games, which are by far the most popular game that people come into grocery stores and liquor stores and places like convenience stores to play, that those would still be sold in the stores. The other two things that the retailers groups want that the lottery has not signed on to is that if you wanted to you'd have to create an account to play any of these lottery games. And so what the retailers want is that you would have to go and purchase or give them the money, and they would apply it to your online account to play. That way they could make sure that you are actually of age, just like they do now. If they would card somebody, if they tried to buy a lottery ticket, they would card you if you bought one of these cards, sort of like you would buy an iTunes gift card, like at CVS. The idea is that you would pick up a card, you know, $25 for Michigan Lottery, and they would check your ID, and then you could go immediately on your phone or go back home and start playing the game.
And if you decided to buy a jumbo Coke Zero and a bag of Fritos, they'd like it even better.
They would definitely like that. That's the biggest drawback that the retailers see to this is that, you know, margins are already so slim in that retail setting, so that if anything that they see is taking away customers that are coming in the door, they're not going to be so keen on. And so, yeah, because they only make on average about a 6% take on any lottery sales or winnings, and so they don't get rich on this. What they get rich on, like you said, is if somebody buys a lottery ticket and then a case of beer or a bottle of pop or a bag of chips. And so if people aren't buying those chips, that's where the problem comes into play.
Now, you'd mentioned Georgia and Illinois have the internet lottery sales. Is it early or too early to figure out if that's having an effect on retailers?
It seems to be too early. I think one of the states, I believe it was Illinois, I think just started last year, and I think the other state, Georgia, has only been around for a year or two. I might have those reversed. So the retail groups haven't really got a good sense for what this has done, but I think their fear and it is still leading this, that they're just concerned that this is going to take people out of the store. And so the other thing that they'd like to do to keep people in the store is that, say, you play an online game on your phone and you win $100. How do you get that $100? Does it go immediately back into your account, or does it go onto your debit card, or would you have to go into the retail store and collect it that way? That's what the retailers want, because they want you to purchase the money on your card in the store, and then they want you to collect your winnings in the store. So, but those two things the lottery has not signed on to just yet.
And any idea when we might be able to hop on that smartphone and play the lottery?
The lottery right now is saying that this could come in either the late third quarter or fourth quarter of next year. So basically, by this time next year, you could be playing gambling on your iPhone.
One more thing for people to do to keep their nose stuck in their iPhone and not conversing with the people across the table from them. Chris Gouts, reporter for Crain's Detroit Business. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
What do you think? Is it a good idea to let folks play the lottery online? Should it be that easy? Just pick up your phone and play. Would you try it out? Let us know. You can find us online. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, we're on Facebook. You can search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And you can always find us on the web, michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. While you're there, you can check out all kinds of stories or conversations that you might have missed. For many of us, death can be an uncomfortable topic, and the details involved in caring for the deceased are best kept out of sight and out of mind. But for students in Wayne State University's mortuary science program, encountering dead bodies begins on the first day of class. It's the only program of its kind in our state. In it, students learn everything from funeral management to embalming and restorative arts. That's the process of rebuilding facial features and preparing bodies for viewing. Wayne State recently hosted its annual public open house in Detroit. Over 500 brave souls took the chance to peek behind the curtain into the world of attending to the dead. Mortuary science student Sarah Eisenbart starts off the tour.
Welcome, welcome. First off, I'd like you to welcome you to the tour.
You excited?
Yeah.
Are you nervous?
I just want you guys to know that if anybody gets queasy when we go on the second floor, there are chairs.
Have a good tour, guys.
Hi, my name is Sarah Eisenbart, and I got interested in this. This is my second career. My first career was in advertising, and so I kind of got sick of the daily, day-to-day deadline. No pun intended.
Right, next floor, the third floor, and it's our restorative arts classroom where we learn how to restore people's features.
My name is Jamie Cameron, and I'm the restorative arts professor here at Wayne State's mortuary science program. When most people think of restorative arts, you automatically start thinking of trauma cases and having to rebuild. But restorative art can be something as simple as properly setting facial features, and, of course, using the proper color enough cosmetic to make sure that the person has a natural appearance.
This is our funeral service museum. So old caskets and coffins, old embalming chemicals, embalming instruments. My name is Mark Evely. I'm the mortuary science program director at Wayne State University. You know, in the early days, embalmings were done largely in the person's home. Funeral directors and embalmers would have kits like these that they could carry with them with all their instruments in them. And, you know, these are the types of machines that we use now, an electronic pump to aid us in the embalming process. What they used to use are these old hand pumps. They would use the hand pumps to inject embalming chemicals in. They would collect blood in these types of containers here. This is the room where autopsies are done. So they can be in there doing the autopsy or in this section in here observing the autopsy. This is our embalming laboratory.
Oh, no. Here we go.
You look like you don't want to be around dead bodies.
Hi, folks. Is this your first trip to mortuary school?
Yes.
My name is Sharon G. I'm the embalming instructor here at Wayne State.
How many people want to be funeral directors now?
Come on. One? Excellent. Good sell. You know, we love what we do. It's a big job, big responsibility. We're the last hands that kind of send that person off. And you've got to have a lot of humanity in these hands because you've got a lot of responsibility. You're taking good care of somebody.
Stateside's John K. Wilson brought us that story from Wayne State University's Mortuary Sciences Open House. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lake Superior is warming up. In fact, scientists say the largest of the Great Lakes is heating up faster than any other lake on Earth. Joining us now is Tim Klein. He's a PhD student at the University of Washington's School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, why is Lake Superior warming up faster than not only the other Great Lakes, but every other lake on Earth?
Lake Superior has seen remarkable warming over the last three decades, and the reason generally scientists attribute it to declining ice cover. And so Lake Superior is the largest lake on Earth by surface area, and relative to the other large Great Lakes in the world, like Baikal or Tanganyika, it's relatively shallow. And over the last 30 years, it's seen a 50% decrease in ice cover. And with a decrease in ice cover, you have less reflectance of solar radiation, so more of it is being absorbed by the water in the lake. And that's the primary driver of lake warming throughout the season and throughout the last 30 years.
Tim, your research found that average Lake Superior surface water temps increased 2.5 degrees Celsius between 1979 and 2006. For those of us who are not scientists, can you help us understand just what that means, and is it a dramatic increase?
It is a large increase, and it may not sound, you know, for an annual cycle, you're used to your temperatures in your house going up and down by way more than that sort of range, but as an average condition, and the way it sort of plays out, at least at the scale for fish habitat, is that it creates longer growing seasons. And that's really the critical piece here. So these longer growing seasons make the difference between surviving winter for juvenile fish or getting to, you know, really large size for anglers or commercial fisheries. So having longer growing seasons and then a few more places in the lake where you can have those long growing seasons is really the critical link to this temperature increase.
So what about the effects on the fish, Tim, in Lake Superior? Are there certain species who are winners and certain species who are losers?
Right, exactly. In any climate change story, you have some species that are going to benefit from warmer temperatures or shifts in their distribution, and you have some species that may not do as well. And so Lake Superior traditionally is a very cold lake, and its fish community reflected that. It was dominated by cold, big water trout and smaller prey fish that all liked that cold water. And with climate change, we've seen an expansion in the spatial extent and the duration of habitat for many of the economically valuable and ecologically valuable fish.
Such as?
The lean lake trout, Chinook salmon, and walleye were the three that we looked at in this study.
Okay. What about the warmer water and its effect on the sea lamprey?
Right. So Jim Kitchell and I are working on a project right now with some other collaborators looking at basically using the same technique and then some observations of sea lamprey body size over the last 50 years. And the interesting thing is that the temperature preference of a sea lamprey is quite warm, but they always occupy the temperature of their host. But because the growing seasons or the length that their host species can achieve those maximum growth rates, the lamprey is actually benefiting from that. Mm. And so what we've seen is a 20% increase in body size, and larger lampreys, they consume more blood, and they'll kill more host fishes, and ultimately they'll lay more eggs, which poses a challenge to a very successful management program, which is currently in place, in that you're going to have a species that the management may need to shift in order to adapt to its changing size and consumption and spatial distributions.
Tim, something that I saw that surprised you as you were studying the warming up of Lake Superior is one side of the lake is warming faster than the other.
Yeah, exactly. And that speaks right to what we were talking about with sea lamprey as well, in that the eastern side of the lake is warming much faster than the western side. And that has to do mostly with the prevailing wind direction, which is that most winds over Lake Superior move from west to east. So as the lake gets warmer, it pushes more of that warm water to the eastern side, and then that cool water on the western side can continue to warm to an even higher. So you end up with greater heat in the eastern side of the lake.
So what do we make of what you've studied?
I think it's important to think about the future of the fish community in Lake Superior. So there's a management goal to restore what was there in Lake Superior prior to fishing and invasive species that have all changed the food web quite a bit. But as we move forward, we may not think that conservation and cooler species like the Siskoet lake trout or conservation of even the lean lake trout, if they start to lose habitat in a warming future, that may not need to be the goal of management anymore. We may need to shift to managing for a warmer species like Chinook salmon or walleye. But I also think, as you mentioned, invasive species are another critical link here. And something like with lamprey, we may want to adapt our management to focus more on the eastern side of the lake, as we know that place, that part of the lake is changing much faster than the other sides. So sort of using this information to adapt our management of both the fisheries and invasive species for better services that we can render from the lake.
Tim Klein is with the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, and he has studied the effect of temperature on fish in Lake Superior as we see Lake Superior warming faster than any other lake on the planet. Tim, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Can there be too much of a good thing? That question is buzzing around the Traverse City area now that the warm months are well behind us. Some residents say they're not too happy with the burst of festivals that draw throngs of visitors. Others say, hey, wait, those festivals and those visitors mean jobs for locals and dollars pumped into the economy. What is the balance that can be struck as Traverse City works to develop a blue economy based on its beautiful freshwater location? Joining me for this conversation is John Flesher. He's a reporter for the Associated Press. He joins us from Traverse City. And with us is Ken Winter, longtime Petoskey newspaper editor and publisher. Ken, I want to start with you and your recent column in Dome Magazine. It waded right into this issue. What are the arguments that you're hearing against having the festivals and this push for more tourists and visitors?
Well, in the last 40 years that I've worked up here, it's been a continual debate as how much is enough or not enough. I think it boils down to the economy for a lot of small communities. And in the case of Traverse City, having had a cottage there for 50 years and now seeing them learn how to use their new open space after tearing down some buildings that used to be on the waterfront, I don't think they've quite figured out what the balance is yet. It used to be traditionally the Cherry Festival and everybody would close down, and then more recently it's been the Film Festival, and now that other people see that space available, they want to be there.
When you refer to open space, John, give us a sense for those who have not visited Traverse City. This open space seems to be the lightning rod for the dispute. What is it, and why has it become the center of this debate?
Well, it is sort of a, you might say, a boring name for the area, but it's really just a stretch of waterfront along Grand Traverse Bay, West Grand Traverse Bay, right in the downtown area of Traverse City. As Ken mentioned, way back when it was more of an industrial area. Now what you have along that area is a beautiful stretch of just of open land. Just think of a nice lengthy waterfront park that it extends along west of Grand Traverse Bay. This is a place that is understandably a magnet for people who just like to go down and be by the water, particularly in summer. There's our recreational trail, the Traverse area, a recreational trail runs through there, so you have a lot of joggers, bikers, walkers. It's just a place where people naturally like to congregate.
When you see, in fact, in your piece, John Flesher, you cited one estimate that tourism pumped $1.2 billion into Traverse City's economy last year. That was up 28% from 2006. So are there people in Traverse City saying, we don't need that money as much as we want our vistas and our open spaces?
I haven't heard anyone say that we don't need that money, and no one is really saying that they don't like tourism. It's as Ken mentioned, it's sort of a matter of striking the balance,
right?
How you make use of the of both the open space and other parks that we have in town here, and how you deal with some of the downsides of tourism. Traffic, heavy traffic, is a big part of that. We also have, you know, the National Cherry Festival in July, and for a long time that was pretty much it. But in recent years, there have been more and more festivals that have popped up. Michael Moore started the Traverse City Film Festival, and then in the winter there's a comedy fest that he has been involved with. And there are a number of others, and for, you know, understandable reasons. This is an area that in the summer is visited quite heavily by tourists, and this is also an area where it is developing a reputation for the restaurants, the farm-to-table restaurants. It's gotten some high rankings as a real foodie haven, that type thing. And the wineries are popping up. There are a lot of craft breweries as well. So they're just, you put it all together, and people are trying to figure out how, you know, how we take full advantage of this for the local economy without you know, going overboard and just ruining it.
If you're just joining me, that was John Flesher. He's a reporter for the Associated Press based in Traverse City. And he is joined by Ken Winter, who's a longtime Petoskey newspaper editor and publisher. As we kind of explore the question of Traverse City and some folks in Traverse City fighting what's called festival fatigue, just too much life and liveliness in terms of festivals and visitors for the residents. And are we seeing, Ken, is this debate playing out in Charlevoix and Petoskey and Harbor Springs? And if so, how is it being discussed and settled?
It's been discussed for many years, and I think there's a definition as to what a community is. Some consider themselves resort communities, such as Charlevoix and Petoskey and Harbor Springs, like have Bayview or have summer associations, and they tend to be more permanent summer residents that like the quietness of the area and aren't bothered by things like July 4th, where they traditionally have parades and art shows and those type of things. The issue in our area becomes more of how much. As far as the early 70s, I can remember the Chamber of Commerce back then when they weren't really looking at large economic development, but more of a postcard literature distribution center with something in their park, East Park, every week, whether it was a hobby craft show or another type of art show or a boat show, whatever it was, they felt that the park had to be filled. Some of the local merchants disagreed and felt that really hurt their business across from the park along the main highway that you cross the bridge on Bridge Street, because people couldn't get into their shops. I think you find that, having had a place in Leonard Peninsula for a long time, I think you find a sort of a conflict as to the type of people that come to the area. Traverse City, like Mackinac City, it seems to attract more of the overnight or week-long visits in hotels or in campgrounds, where some of the other communities really have their people spending more time in cottages that they own or rent.
Got it.
Because of that, there's this internal conflict.
Now, As I think about this, and I am kind of familiar with the area, too, because my parents bought a cottage in Kalkaska back in 1971. So we've had years, and then they retired in Fife Lake, and we would scoot in on the supply road, back road into Traverse. And I've watched it evolve over the years. And it made me wonder, when you talk about the opposition to this, to so much in the lines of festivals and tourism, is that coming less from longtime residents and more from folks who retired, maybe worked downstate and then retired and maybe are well off and have a real nice house on Mission Point and really would rather not have all those visitors?
Interesting you mention that. When I wrote the column that you mentioned for Dome Magazine a couple weeks ago, I got a call from somebody who's from a longtime local person who said that the issue is it's the new people coming in that want to change the character. We really want the tourism. We like the parades. We like the festivals. And it's these new people that want to change everything, which was the opposite reason why they came in the first place.
Yeah, you have that debate here in Traverse City as well. The gentleman who this past summer went to the city officials and I think somewhat tongue-in-cheek proposed throwing what he called the Quiet Festival, which would be reserving the open space for a time where absolutely nothing would go on there except just, you know, people going down and having fun. He said he was serious, but at the same time, I think he had kind of was making a humorous point. And this was a fellow who has visited the area for some time, but just recently moved here full-time to retire. And you do have people, they call them transplants, you know, people who are fairly recent arrivals and are sometimes accused of wanting to sort of, you know, pull up the drawbridge after they get in.
Right.
And whether it's fair or not, there is that impression that you have some people who like it here, who come here. Once they arrive, they want to, you know, prevent anyone else from coming and from making any changes. Then you have others who come along who perhaps lived in big cities and would like to have some of the amenities that they enjoyed in the big city while still enjoying the small town atmosphere. And so then you have people who've been here for generations, like things the way they are. And so there is that dynamic and that tension.
So how do you each think this is going to play out as far as these many viewpoints, all of them very valid as you talk to the folks who hold them? What do you each think is a way to strike a balance between pulling in those tourist dollars and the jobs they create and also preserving the peace and the beauty of what makes Northern Michigan, Northern Michigan? Ken, I'll have you start.
Well, I think John's in the thick of things right now in Traverse City, but from my reading and talking to people, I like the process that they're going about, and that's a slow hearing process. You know, they're going to not jump in and issue all kinds of permits for everybody. They want to have a fair and even-handed permit process with some balance and public hearings. I really think it's like all the other communities around here. It's just a political process, and it's going to be mediation and some compromise and trying to figure out where we want to be.
And John Flesher?
Yeah, I think that says it pretty well. We do have a newly elected city commission. This was a topic of discussion during the campaign, not the only one, but people are very aware of it. I think there will be a deliberative process. The commission had already started a study of this issue before the election, and now that we have some new faces on the commission, there will be a pretty intense and an in-depth discussion, and I think they will try to find that balance because, as I mentioned, people certainly, I think, would prefer a tourist-oriented economy to a smokestack economy of old, and people recognize the value of having tourism here, of having a desirable place that people want to visit, and at the same time, it's a wonderful place to live, and they want to preserve that. So there will be a lot of give and take, and they'll refine their policies and see where we end up.
I want to just interject. I don't think it's an issue that people are opposed to it. I think even the permanent summer or seasonal residents appreciate the money that comes in economically, and I saw those figures that John had put in his story, and I mean, they're substantial, and because of them coming here, we're able to have a lot of these nice restaurants and amenities that, quite frankly, sitting here right now, there aren't a lot of people on the streets, so they have to make their money in the summer.
That was Ken Winter. He's the longtime Petoskey newspaper editor and publisher, and he was joined by John Flesher from Traverse City, who is a reporter for the Associated Press. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Farms are in the spotlight on Capitol Hill, or more to the point, the lack of a new farm bill. The old farm bill expired October 1st. A new one is more than 2 years overdue. So far, congressional leaders have not been inclined to consider passing yet another short-term extension. Leaders of the House and Senate Agricultural Committees met today, trying to work out differences between their respective bills as they face a deadline of January 1. Without a new farm bill by that date, trips to the grocery store could bring on serious sticker shock, especially when you push your cart along the dairy aisle. Joining us once again to look at the progress toward getting a farm bill and what could happen if Congress can't pass a new one is Ryan Findley. He's the National Legislative Counsel for the Michigan Farm Bureau. Welcome back to the program, Ryan.
Thank you. I appreciate being back on.
And Ryan is joined by David Swikert, who's a professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. David, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Ryan, we've been hearing the term now. We talked about the fiscal cliff. That was everything that we heard about in October. Now we're hearing the term dairy cliff, which does not have a very promising ring to it. If Congress cannot approve a new farm bill or another stopgap measure, what'll happen to that gallon of milk?
Well, if we revert back to permanent law, which is what would happen come January 1, it actually sets a plan in place, but we would see dairy prices for all products, cheese, fluid dairy milk, sour cream, yogurt, all of that would skyrocket in the stores. We would see a dramatic increase in those prices, and that is not what farmers want. The last thing a farmer wants is to see that happen. I understand consumers don't want to see that happen. Farmers definitely don't want to see that happen. Their goal is to provide affordable, healthy food to people, and we don't want to see that happen at the end of the year. But if Congress doesn't act, it sets in motion what will become or what could become parity-based system for dairy provisions in agriculture. But we're a long ways from that right now. I think that's a threat that everybody has in front of them, but Congress has some time to act yet. And even if we don't have something by January 1, that is when USDA has to go through the protocol of implementing this parity-based system. So we have a little bit of time after January 1. As all deadlines in D.C. go, there is some flexibility with that January 1 deadline.
We are hearing talk from you know, big names in Washington that we could see milk at $7 a gallon. And, David, I wanted to get your take and have you explain to us, just as America's farm policy reverts to what's called this permanent law, what is that? And why would it have such a big effect on prices that we pay for dairy products?
Well, what we call permanent legislation is basically the 1948 Farm Bill. And the 1948 Farm Bill was very different from what we have today in terms of the 2008 Farm Bill. In those days, farm policy was primarily price support levels that were established at much higher levels than market prices today. And so those price support levels would then begin to accumulate government stocks, government purchases of surpluses, until you drove the market price up to that higher price support level. Mm. The reason that we stopped using that policy, basically in 1973, but particularly in 1996, the reason we stopped using that policy is basically for that very reason, that higher price support levels created government surplus purchases that tended to cut into U.S. exports of farm products, and it was a bit more expensive for consumers at the grocery store. We replaced that with a policy that is based more directly on allowing producers to sell whatever they produce at whatever price it will bring, and then paying a target price out of the federal treasury. That increased the cost for taxpayers but reduced it as consumers. And so Congress made the decision in 73 and 96 that that was preferable to a high price support policy. And so that's the difference between what we have done in more recent years versus what we did back in 48, and
okay,
that's why there would be such a dramatic difference.
So if U.S. policy reverts to this old law, then that means the government would go into the marketplace and be buying the milk and the butter and the cheese at, what, about double the going rate? And you're saying from where you sit, Ryan, that's not what farmers want?
Not at all. Not at all. Farmers want to make sure that people are buying their product. And if we were to have an instance where the price of pizza were to double because of the cost of cheese, or the price of that fluid milk were to double or more than double, consumers aren't going to pay those prices. They'll switch to another product. Hmm. And that has an immediate and a long-term impact on the dairy industry. And that's not good for Michigan agriculture. Dairy is the number one industry within agriculture from a product standpoint in Michigan. And we have dairy farmers all over the state, and they don't want this. This is bad policy, but it's a threat. It's a threat for Congress, just like we had the fiscal cliff that you alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
This is a threat for Congress to take action.
So it's supposed to be so unpleasant that it will force them to take action. And we saw that didn't work too well with the fiscal cliff. We toppled right over that cliff.
Unfortunately, we did, yeah. But on this one, I think there's a lot. There's some confidence still in Congress that they can do this. But I will tell you, I've talked to farmers, well over 100 farmers in the last couple of days at Michigan Farm Bureau's annual meeting, and they are exasperated. They are completely exasperated with Congress and the fact that they're 2 years late, as you mentioned, on a farm bill, and they haven't finished it. And farmers say, look, we have to get our crops in, we have to get them out of the field, we have to sell it, we have to pay our bills. Why can't Congress do that? And so there is some exasperation, and I think members of Congress are hearing that, they're recognizing that, and Senator Stabenow and the other leaders that are working on the conference committee, they're meeting today, they're scheduled to meet later this week to iron out the details and hopefully put the gears in motion that will allow us to have a farm bill before the end of the year.
David, as well as distorting the market, if indeed we go over this dairy cliff and revert to this permanent law, would we also see supply issues?
Well, in that regard, I think it's important to note that the 1948 bill was written in an entirely different world from what we have today in U.S. agriculture. I'll give you an example. There's been a lot of emphasis on dairy, and that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1948, soybeans were not a major crop in this country. There is nothing in the 1948 Farm Bill about soybean programs. As soybeans became a major crop in the second half of the 20th century, Congress added a soybean program. If you were to allow the 2008 Farm Bill to expire, there would be no soybean program. And so it's not just that you're going to have changes such as dairy. You're going to have other programs, other crops, where the existing program no longer exists because the crop basically didn't exist back in 1948. So when we talk about shifts, rather than dramatic change in supply, I think we would see some significant shifts in acreage rather than major impacts on supply. In fact, I could paint you a picture where this would actually increase supply because it's going to dramatically increase the prices paid for crops and dairy. But so the supply would increase, but the composition, the mix of crops would change.
Okay. That was David Swikert, who's a professor at Michigan State University, and he's joined by Ryan Findley with the Michigan Farm Bureau as we look at the fact that, as of yet, Congress has not been able to pass a new farm bill. And the three of us talked about this together back in the summer. Is it still the big sticking point between the two versions of the farm bill, the amount to be cut from the SNAP program, the so-called food stamp program? Is that the big stumbling block? We know the House wants to cut $40 billion from SNAP. The Senate wants to cut $4 billion. That's a lot of reconciling to do.
I think there's two major issues. One would be that, trying to figure out, do we cut $4 billion or $40 billion, or do we, would Congress ever think of compromising and finding something in between there to agree to? And the other side is, what is the appropriate agricultural safety net? Today we have a program that is called a direct payment, and based on what you've historically grown, not what you are planting that year, but what you've historically grown, you receive a payment from the government. Irregardless of how that crop does or what the market conditions are, you receive this direct payment. That program is being eliminated, and there is a discussion of how do we replace that, what is the appropriate safety net, and to what level does that coverage benefit growers. And there are some regional differences right now that people are trying to figure that out. But there are both components. I think the bright one that everybody sees is the $4 billion in the Senate cut and $40 billion in the House cut when it comes to nutrition. And I will point out that that is over a 10-year period. When we say $4 billion or $40 billion, that is over 10 years. And that is over the cost of that program is around $80 billion a year right now. So when we look at $4 and $40 billion, I think it's important that people, listeners, understand that is not a huge cut to the program. Does it impact recipients? Absolutely. And that's a serious discussion, and it warrants a serious discussion. But there's more than just 4 and 40. There's some background knowledge to that.
I look at it as exactly the same as Ryan does in terms of what are the sticking points. Number one is that large gap in the size of the SNAP cuts. Number two is in the design of the commodity programs for the different crops. And in particular, the SNAP cut difference is the largest one. I'll remind you that the House defeated earlier this year, the House defeated a farm bill that had a $20 billion cut in SNAP because a large number of Republicans voted against it because it was too large. A large number of Republicans voted against it because $20 billion was too small.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of Democrats voted against it because it was too large. That was over $20 billion. I think they're going to have a very difficult time finding a point that they can agree on and then actually have the – remember, this has to go back to the two houses of Congress and be voted on. I think they're going to have a very difficult time finding a number that can satisfy the two houses when this bill goes – if this bill goes back to both houses.
So basically we're – kind of seeing that the same kinds of philosophical battles about what government should be doing and what it should be spending money on, the same battles that kind of blew up the budget process is also gumming this up.
I would argue that it's exactly the same. This is a fundamental argument about the nature of government in the U.S., and the differences are rather large. It's playing out here on a small scale, in the sense of a single bill versus the large scale of the overall budget, but it's the exact same question being played out both times.
And based on what the entire nation saw happen during October with the fiscal cliff and debt ceiling debates, do either of you hold out hope that Congress will do better with this farm bill?
Yes, I do. I work with farmers, and they're the eternal optimist, and so it's worn off a little bit on me. And I am optimistic that Congress is going to find a solution. They will pass this bill, but I think that from a logistical standpoint, it will be very difficult to do that before the end of this year. I think that we will likely see passage of the farm bill at some point in January before the devastating impacts take effect on dairy or possibly other commodities. So I think that we will have one, but I think it will be early in the first of the year.
And David, do you share Ryan's farmer-bred optimism?
I'd like to, but I don't know that I can. To me, it's a numbers game, and the numbers it's going to be hard making the numbers add up. And the numbers I'm referring to is the number of votes you have to have in the House, 218, to pass a final bill. And how do you get there when this House has already defeated a farm bill with a $20 billion cut in SNAP? I don't know whether you go larger or smaller than $20 billion. To try to get a majority of 218, but I think that's going to be a very large chore, and I think we are in a test of the ability of the legislative process in this country to work. I did not think we would be here when we first went to conference. I was optimistic that they would probably be able to work something out rather quickly, but with every day that passes, that optimism fades because I have a harder and harder time seeing how you get numbers to add up to 218.
So what if they cannot come to some way to reconcile the House and Senate versions, would it be such a bad thing to pass another short-term extension? Is that the lesser of the two evils, if you will?
But there's not a lot of energy to do that in D.C. right now. The White House has said no. You've had several Senate leadership members of the Senate leadership that have indicated they don't want to see an extension. When you talk to staff or you talk to members of Congress, they're exhausted from talking about the Farm Bill over and over again. They want to see it pass. If they can't come to that magic number of 218, then that will be the discussion. Do they disrupt markets, which I don't think they would do. I think they would go with a short-term extension. But I just don't see either of those options looking very good for Congress right now. They want to move this off of their plate.
And what are your thoughts on another short-term extension, David?
Well, I guess I have to go back. Once again, Ryan said that allowing this to expire and go back to the 1948 legislation was sort of too horrible to contemplate. Well, I'll just remind everyone that the idea of sequestration was supposed to be too horrible to contemplate and would force us to make a decision on the future of the budget. Nothing happened, and sequestration is a fact. The notion that we could not, that this is so horrible that we wouldn't do it, simply doesn't make sense to me, not in this political world where no one can show me how to get to 218, given the large gap in differences and the unwillingness to compromise. We've got people saying that legislative bills should not even go to conference because there might be a compromise made. That's the political world we're living in today. And in that kind of a world, policy outcomes become totally random. And so I don't think it's impossible that we would take this step. I would not have said that even a few weeks ago, but I would say it today.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and we'll see if Ryan's optimism is borne out, or David, with your accurate views of what happened with sequestration. We will watch this story continue to play out and continue to follow it. And we want to thank you so much for talking with us. Ryan Finley is the National Legislative Counsel for the Michigan Farm Bureau, and David Swikert is a professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And that's our program for today. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.